On the Vocalo hotline, we've got the soundtrack for your Friday nights. If you need to hear that one song you love or want a dedicated track to that special someone, I'm taking your calls and DMs. Tune in every Friday night at 8, both on WBEZ and Vocalo.org.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise.
Hey Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Stick around till the end of this episode to get the latest on what's happening in and around Chicago with a panel of our WBEZ and Chicago Sun-Times colleagues. But first, as Pride celebrations continue this month, some of Chicago's queer elders are reflecting on how far the LGBTQ plus community has come and what remains at stake today. At a time when the Trump administration has made moves to restrict federal recognition of transgender people and roll back protections for LGBTQ plus Americans, many are looking to leaders who helped build the movement for guidance. In this episode of the pod, we'll hear from elders who are preparing to share their perspectives of Chicago's queer history at an upcoming event at the Dorothy Bar in the Westtown neighborhood. At the table with me was Karen Morris, co-founder of the LGBTQ plus Intergenerational Dialogue Project. The 52-year-old will be moderator of the Queer Elder Panel. Norma Celadon is the Director of Leadership Development and Capacity Building at Equality Illinois. She's 63 and will be on the Queer Elder History Panel alongside Jay Myers, a 70-year-old storyteller and graduate of the LGBTQ plus Intergenerational Dialogue Project. We started off our conversation by talking about what's top of mind for everyone this Pride Month, and Norma kicked things off.
I believe that these spaces are essential right now for everyone in the community. It's important for people to feel that they are connected, that they are validated, and so couldn't be prouder to be taking the lead, making sure creating spaces that are safe for our community.
Mm-hmm. Jay?
Oh, I agree totally. I think it does well for all of us, and not just queer people, but other people outside of our community, to hear stories and to hear our truth and to be able to recognize humanity and those sorts of things between us. It's really important to be visible.
Yeah.
And to speak your life, your truth.
And Karen?
For us, I think, especially with Pride, I think I've seen a lot of people be conflicted. You know, what should we do? Should we be like, you know, angry or, you know, protesting? And we should do all of those things. And I also think, you know, queer joy is resistance. And so I think a lot of what's lovely about Pride in these moments is there we celebrate the joy as well as everything else. So like with our storytellers, you know, we'll hear about things that are not joyful, but just the fact of us being together and being ourselves, it's when we connect, that community is extremely joyful and it's really important.
Who were the queer elders that made an impression on you, Norma?
You know, I have to say that queerness around me was not an option. It was not something that was visible, which makes it even more important for me to be out and proud and unapologetic in these times.
So no mentors at the time, no one that you could lean on as a role model because what people weren't out?
As a young professional, I had an inkling about supervisors or people around me, but wasn't quite sure. I didn't even have a language for those individuals.
Interesting. Anybody you looked up to, Jay?
I lived in a very isolated realm of my own, I thought, when I was growing up. I never had any peers or any adults in my life who were supportive of my very early on discovery that I was in the wrong body as a three-year-old. And I talked about it quite openly, and it made adults and whatever uncomfortable.
What did they say?
Well, you know, it was just the idea, there was a stigma that I was crazy, which, yeah, I think I am a little. But and so it was never talked about. And so I had no idea that the queer world even existed, and especially the trans world, until I saw a copy of Newsweek magazine in like 1974 mm-hmm. on the cover talking about me, in a sense. And so I never had anybody. The closest I can come to is one of my cohorts from New York, my New York days, and the activism, the protests. And Sue Cummings was a incredible lesbian, and she was strong, and she was out, and she was proud. Mm-hmm. And I learned, I was only 21, and I learned so much from
her. Oh, I can imagine you thinking, oh, wow.
I was a baby.
Mm. So how do you feel now? I mean, you are one of the elders, and you can sort of do sort of a different turn for folks in that next generation, and you are living, you are existing, and they're able to look at you and sort of emulate your path.
Happened to me just yesterday.
Really?
I'm from downstate, Shenoah, Illinois, and I was in a train station in Pontiac, Illinois, and I was alone with a young person, and I just said, sort of sized up the, you know, and I said, are you trans? And this young man said, yes, I am. And I said, well, so am I. So here we are in this train station, and he was 20. And I said, I'm 70. So there's this huge
wow.
gap. And we talked all the way to Chicago. Oh. And he said to me at the end, he said, meeting you and hearing about your life means that I have a chance to be happy. And I said, absolutely, kiddo.
I think this is what we're talking about, Karen, this intergenerational dialogue. Tell me more about why that's important
mm-hmm.
and what should we know about what's happening this Thursday?
So one thing to know about the LGBTQ population community is that there's very little to no contact between generations, especially like the youngers that would be in their 20s, 30s, and then folks that are 60 up. So it's different than other groups that might have grown up with somebody like them in their family. Mm-hmm. Most of us still grow up with not an open person in our family. And society and education has worked to keep LGBTQ adults away from children, you know, whether in schools or these sorts of things. So it's a huge gap that just doesn't happen, because I didn't have a queer elder either to look up to, you know? So with the LGBTQ Intergenerational Dialogue Project, who's the one hosting the event along with Gerber Hart Library and Archives and Dorothy Downstairs, it started 7 years ago. It started with four professors at three different college universities who were teaching students that were realizing over time that none of our students realized that queer elders over 50 existed. Mm. Like, they thought they were all dead because they didn't see them, and that they didn't think they themselves would live past 40.
Wow.
And so some of us were working, one of our colleagues, Adam Gredeman, was working at Center in Halsted with elders there. So it really was an experiment. What if we get elders and youngers together, feed them and water them, and get out of the way? And it was it's amazing. So I think from that, it really became a bigger and bigger project, and it's become a community.
Yeah.
So it's become a really big community. So this is one of our events that we do. It's the fourth time we're doing it, where we get to come together with a lot of younger folks we don't know. So we have a lot of younger folks in our project, but these are every year. It sells out every year. Which the first
imagine.
Time we had the event, the elders on the panel were really worried, because they said, nobody's going to pay to come see us talk. Mm-hmm. And it sells out every year. And it's younger people that drive from all sorts of places to hear elders. We have a slideshow, so we show images. They talk about their lives. It's important.
Yeah. Norma, speaking of lives, I mean, you've lived a great one. You emigrated from Mexico.
Correct.
You built your adult life here in Chicago. You've mm-hmm. had a storied career, including working in domestic violence prevention mm-hmm. in Latino communities. So what's it like bringing that kind of work to the LGBTQ plus space?
I want to state also, in terms of visibility, what's important here also is the intersectionality.
Yes.
And so you mentioned Latinidad. I think that for us who respect elders, to know that there are elders that are also queer is highly, highly important, mm-hmm. especially because a lot of folks have lost their families. In earlier days, when I participated as a co-founder of Amigas Latinas, that was something that was central to our work. We brought our skills, and talking about same gender violence was very, very important. And so some of us who had social work degrees or had that experience, it was important to also bring it to that space to make sure that women who were attracted to women were also having healthy relationships.
Mm-hmm. And the Amigas Latinas work that you're referencing, I mean, this is, we're talking the 90s?
Yes, that was in the mid-90s that we were established. We started, and there were movements that happened before then, but I think Amigas hit it off because of the model that we used. We were meeting in women's homes, and women felt comfortable, and it was sort of like a sisterhood. And, you know, we all talk about the first time that we walked into somebody's living room and that there were all of these women who loved women, and it just felt like coming home again. Mm.
What were the rallying cries in the trans communities that you were part of, Jay, when you were younger?
Well, the fact of the matter is that when I moved to New York in 1976, there was a job opening at the National Gay Task Force that I wanted. And I was told, I was given a tip, don't tell them you're trans, be a lesbian. So I actually went to the library and read up on being a lesbian.
You pulled a book called How to Be a Lesbian.
I know.
And you read it within 30 minutes.
Okay, yeah, because the one I was going to be, I was going to be a writer with them. And I was like, so I
wow.
I was in the closet inside of a national gay organization because transgenderism was not looked upon favorably mm-hmm. by the movement then. They made efforts to stop trans people and from being in the pride, the early pride parades and so forth.
Have you seen a shift in society and in attitudes?
Yes,
and totally. How has that impacted you?
It makes it less dangerous for me to say hi. I'm Jay. I'm trans. It makes it, I think, a little more difficult maybe to fire us because that happened a lot.
Mm.
Didn't matter what you were doing. You know, they found out you were trans or you said something about it openly, and you suddenly found you were no longer the director of elections for McLean County.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Karen, what were the rallying cries, you know, in communities that you were a part of when you were younger?
Mm. I was in North Carolina in the 90s when I came out, and that was this kind of scary time. And I think for me especially, and I didn't really know many people. I mean, we found each other through nightclubs, right? Which was fantastic because those are the nightclubs where everybody would, if there's one in your town, everyone goes there. It's not like divided, right? So in terms of intersectionality, everyone's there. So I ended up going to San Francisco for grad school. And I actually had an uncle who advised my mother not to let me go because it would encourage my gayness. And I had a full ride there, but that was worth, for him, it was worth giving up 5 years paid at a doctorate program at Stanford mm-hmm. for me not to be gay. So when I went there, I think that's when I really became much more aware of politics and all of that stuff and Halstead. So at the time, it was really about partying, finding love. But also it was really starting to be about claiming spaces. So there was a lesbian bar in San Francisco for a long time. And that was unheard of to be able to kind of keep one lesbian bar going. So it was also, you know, finding spaces for community. And I think as I was there too, trans issues started to become important in San Francisco, like by 2000.
Mm. Jay, we got to mention, you know, trans rights are under attack across the country. This spring, we saw the Supreme Court strike down Colorado's ban on LGBTQ+ conversion therapy for kids. In February, the Kansas State Legislature's invalidated driver's licenses and birth certificates for people who change their gender markers. Do you feel, I know you said a second ago that, you know, at least nowadays I can, you know, not have too much fear introducing myself and saying I'm Jay and I'm trans.
There's always a little bit, yeah.
But I don't know, if I'm outside the community, I do feel like we're going backwards. Am I wrong?
I think in a sense it's a backwards compliment that they are talking about us and coming up with this negative, punitive legislation and so forth. They recognize us. We're there. We're here. And then now we are a threat. So they're going to fight us, you know, above the table, whereas before it was always sort of below the table.
Mm-hmm.
So because the more they push, the more we get to push back. and the more dialogue is going to happen in public, in the national media and so forth. And so people can make their own decisions on where they stand for this. And there's so many people in my town, absolutely, they're like, I just think that they're being awfully mean to you people. You know,
you people.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, in the town that I live in, there are other trans people. It's a freak of data, you know, collection that you could have so many in such a small town.
You live in rural Illinois.
1,800 people.
Wow.
Yeah. It's farm country. So the more they push and get mean or whatever, we can take it because that's what we came up in. But it's an opportunity to talk about the issues, and that's important, and it's gonna settle in our favor.
Norma, tell me what you're learning from today's younger queer and trans people, or even some of the movements happening these days.
I just want to first piggyback off of what Jay has mentioned.
Sure,
these are opportunities to really expand our knowledge and the history. Two-spirit people; these identities have existed for millennia. And not only in the U.S., this is across the world. And there were moments where individuals who held these identities were venerated and considered sacred. So these are opportunities to share those stories, to push back, not only as something that started with Stonewall. We have been here for a long, long time, and we are going to continue to be here for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I think that what's important of connecting across generations is that there is this exchange of passion and energy, and it goes both ways. And so having these opportunities to share that history, to share that knowledge, and to share that energy and continue as elders and feeding off of that energy is really essential during these times.
Last word to you, Karen. Tell me what's inspiring you these days.
I think this community. So, you know, the Dialogue Project now has at least 200 people that have been through either a 4-month or a 9-month cycle of being together for 3 hours every other week as a community and getting to know each other. My goal is always to get to know each other well enough that they both tease each other and they drive each other crazy.
Right.
You know, because then that's where you get conversation. So I think what's inspiring me is those of us, you know, even this kind of community, you were bringing up intersectionality, Norma. And I think one thing is society and just how it is has done a very good job at dividing LGBTQ folks along lines of race, class, gender, sexuality, geography in Chicago, right? Mm-hmm. And so for us, and I think we're really realizing it, it's essential to dialogue across those lines because that's where you find political power. So for me, seeing that happen, and I know even in our community, we know that with what's going on now, it's the most vulnerable in our community that are going to be really impacted. So we can say in some places it's an opportunity. At the same time, it's really impacting negatively.
Sure.
And I see folks coming together to care for each other.
We've been talking with Norma Celedon and Jay Myers, who are going to be participating in a queer elder history panel this Thursday, moderated by Karen Morris. For more information, jump online and visit gerberhart.org. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Sasha.
Thank you, Sasha.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise.
Let's turn to the top local news stories of today. From all things sports to James Beard Awards to politics, we got a lot to recap. We were joined by WBEZ's Claire Lane and Courtney Kippers and Mitchell Armantrout of the Chicago Sun-Times. We started off by talking about Game 3 of the NBA Finals, where the New York Knicks faced off with the San Antonio Spurs last night. Claire went first.
I made it through the first half.
All right.
Because nice. I have an early bedtime.
you do. Okay, so you get a pass for that. Mitch, were you watching like I was?
Absolutely. It's Wemby's year, or maybe his year. Certainly last night was his night.
Yeah, it was. I have a little bit of a bone to pick, though. I am rooting for the Knicks, and I thought the refs were insane.
I'm rooting for the Knicks, too.
They weren't like making it. The calls they were supposed to be making, Mitch.
Yeah, a lot of controversial replays. I hadn't actually watched much of the playoffs up to this point. But yeah, just a lot of back and forth there late.
How much do we think the presence of the Donald Trump had anything to do with?
It was significant. I really do think it was significant because it required the players to get there, 3 or 4 hours
early
in advance of the game for security reasons. Fans, too, were, I think, asked to get there 2 hours before the game.
They couldn't bring a bag of any kind.
Right. That's right.
So
there was a nervous energy in the air.
Yeah, totally.
And then he fell asleep. Anyone see footage of that?
I did not.
Yeah.
He did appear to be dozing
off. So is that alleged, or you saw it with your own two eyes?
I saw with my own two eyes the president of the United States falling asleep amid the game that he shut down the city for. I'm just saying.
Although they were not showing him much on the broadcast when I was watching. I didn't see him on TV. I saw some clips on Twitter.
Well, after he was booed during the anthem, I think they decided
to. Which was expected.
Cool
I think
it.
That New York, that was the word on the street.
Totally.
From my New York sources.
Well, listen, there was also a notable Chicagoan at Madison Square Garden last night. Courtside, mind you. Kind of near Larry David. Did anyone
Rahm
catch
Emanuel.
Him?
Yeah.
Yeah, and just about every single shot in like perfect focus. It was kind of weird after a while. Just could not get away from Rahm there.
Or you've just been covering him so long, your eye is trained.
That's true.
Just spot him in a crowd.
It's involuntary at this point.
I don't know. One free throw, I was like, oh my gosh, Rahm Emanuel, Larry David. I'm like, what is happening
Did
here?
You not hit rewind?
Yeah, I hit rewind to go back to be like, what is going on
Let
here?
Me make sure here. Well, Mitch, you know, Rahm Emanuel's name is strangely in the air, right? I mean, he's also hinting at a possible return to national politics, isn't he?
Yeah, he's kind of been telegraphing that like since last fall. If he's kind of been doing the podcast circuit. He's been on all the talk shows. He's been on CNN since he left Chicago just as a commentator. But yeah, now this past couple of weeks, he's been doing this bike tour through New Hampshire, which obviously is a key early primary state. And, you know, a lot of whispers about him potentially running for president in 2028. And we've seen him sort of position himself as this moderate Democrat answer to you know, basically the wing of the party that says that they went too far to the left in losing in 2024. So we've heard him take, you know, a lot of comments about Democrats focusing too much on bathrooms and transgender rights, really taking pretty pretty centrist views there to the national stage. And I think, hard to think that buying seats right in the, you know, the main camera view at the NBA Finals isn't a calculated effort, too.
For sure. Let's get an update, Claire, on the parking meter deal that Chicagoans love to hate. There was this potential plan for it to be sold to a New York investment firm, but Alders are souring on that deal. What's going on?
Yeah, this is a coalition of alderpersons who are saying that Mayor Johnson is keeping them in the dark and has kept them in the dark. The entire city council in the dark, really, every step of the way about this sort of parking meter journey. They were maybe going to sell it, then the bid was going to be triple the amount of remaining money on the initial deal that Richard M. Daley struck back in 2008 that was supposed to last 75 years. So now this group of alders is saying they plan to reject any proposed sale of Chicago's parking meters to this New York investment from at least 22 city council members at this point are pushing to block that transfer.
So what were the sticking points?
Yeah, in a letter, they accused Johnson of being dishonest with them, his entire administration, of withholding just critical information. They're saying they don't have enough info to really make an educated decision on this. And also they're criticizing him for secretly agreeing to a pushed-up deadline that would be June 30th for the council to have to vote on the sale. In a statement, though, Johnson is maintaining that the date isn't a deadline, you know, to finalize anything. It's just deadline to, you know, provide a report on what the council is doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of alders, Claire, one of them is calling for stricter rules on Chicago's nightlife.
Yes. Yesterday on your show, we were discussing Chicago had a fairly violent weekend, and that was citywide. So it also included a shooting in Lincoln Park on the north side. So 43rd Ward Alderman Timmy Knudsen said that the shooting, this was on Belden Avenue, while it was an isolated incident that stemmed from a bar fight, essentially that spilled out from Lincoln onto Belden, he's saying that corridor, that stretch of the area, has become kind of a hot spot for altercations and for violence. And he's saying that this shooting is prompting him to ask officials to reevaluate use of the area, potentially have some stricter curfews so these bars can't stay open so late, things like that. And he wants a little bit of a crackdown on what's going on in Lincoln Park on the north side.
Courtney, there's a new art exhibit in other news. This is about Emmett Till. Tell us what we should know.
Yeah, sure. This is called From Memory to Movement, Emmett at 85. This is a new group exhibit in Bronzeville at the Blanc Gallery from curator Raymond A. Thomas. And it really sort of imagines the future that both Emmett Till and other Black children who have been killed were really robbed of.
Mm-hmm. And so much, as we know, of Emmett Till's story has focused on his death, right? That's when we got to know his name, understandably. But this exhibit seems different.
Yeah, like I said, it really sort of imagines what his life could have looked like had he lived and been able to grow up and get married and have children and grandchildren. As the exhibit's name suggests, this summer would have been Till's 85th birthday. And so that is really sort of marking this occasion. And it also underscores that learning about this history is really under attack right now with book censorship and the rolling back of DEI programs. So the curator told our colleague Erica Thompson that it's really artists' job to be doing the educating around this history right now.
And folks can check this out at Bronzeville's Blanc Gallery through till July 25th.
That's right, this summer. Yep.
Mitch, back to you. The U.S. attorney, Andrew Boutros, he's under fire again.
He sure is.
Or still.
Yes.
Yeah, still, I
ongoing
say.
Fire.
What is it today?
Today, there was a coalition of 111 former federal prosecutors in Chicago's federal court, basically calling on him to step down in light of the Broadview 6 controversy that we've been talking about for several weeks now. This was several Midway Blitz protesters who were initially charged with felonies for interfering with immigration enforcement. Those charges were then downgraded and eventually dropped because of these revelations that prosecutors in Boutros' office had basically engaged in misconduct with the grand jury that eventually brought those charges. That misconduct, it's basically the idea is that some of these prosecutors, or at least one of them, it's called vouching. They say that's when, the prosecutor who's presenting the case is like, you got to trust me on this. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of a big deal. It's got to be legitimate because it's coming from me. And this is a group of more than 100 former prosecutors, Democrats, Republicans, independents, basically saying that this is not something that they would have ever stood for when they were in the office. And they want to see some serious changes as a result.
Goodness. Courtney, it's nearly James Beard Awards time again. Remind folks who aren't familiar, what are the James Beard Awards?
The Yummies.
Sure. Ooh, I like that. These, they're sometimes called the Oscars of the food world. It really is the top prize in the American culinary scene. And so it's coming back to Chicago, happening next Monday.
All right. Some events are leading up to the awards, though, next week. How can folks kind of gear up for the big night?
There is so much happening. It really all kicks off on Friday. And then there are so many events happening across town all weekend. There are brunches, collaborations with out-of-town restaurants. There's a night market happening at Lilac Tiger in Wicker Park. There are just a lot happening all weekend round.
Oh, my goodness. What are you going to try to hit up?
I might.
I'll go where you go.
Yeah, I might try and go to that night market. That sounds really cool. And then also Sanders Barbecue, much beloved restaurant, is collaborating with Mahari. And these are really two of Chicago's most exciting restaurants right now. Mm-hmm. And they're teaming up for a brunch on Sunday. So this sounds quite delicious.
It really has become like the collab of collabs.
Yeah, it's really a weekend for collabs.
Mm-hmm.
In the age of collabs.
Earlier we talked about basketball, Claire. Now I want to switch to soccer. Teams around the world are flying into the U.S. ahead of the start of the World Cup, and it hasn't quite been smooth sailing.
Right. Friendly reminder, the World Cup begins on Thursday.
Oh, wow.
And I know a lot of bars, a lot of restaurants in Chicago are going to be opening early to just sort of accommodate every match, even though we're not having any games here, though some
teams are flying into Chicago. There were some training matches. There was a big match Germany-USA over the weekend. But as we know, President Trump's immigration enforcement efforts and deportation campaigns have caused issues across the country for months. Mm-hmm. And now this is starting to impact some of his extreme measures, impact FIFA, World Cup teams, as well as officials, even just staff on some of these teams. So the latest from the Sun-Times was that U.S. Customs and Border denied entry to an Iraq national soccer team photographer who flew into O'Hare.
This was
on Friday. So agents also reportedly questioned an Iraqi player from that team for hours as the team arrived to play an exhibition match. Mm-hmm. Also, the Iranian national team training in Tijuana, Mexico, because they weren't really given much option of where to train and where to camp here in the USA, facing a slew of visa denials, too. Trump essentially also banned the Iranian team from being in the U.S. overnight.
Wow.
So they can play their matches here. They have a match in L.A., or rather in Inglewood, but then they are going to have to spend their nights likely back in Tijuana or in another country. As a response to what's happening here in the Illinois area, the Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights is actually going to hold a press conference this afternoon at 1 o'clock to just talk about, you know, what's going on and what people need to know.
Yeah, and despite the trouble, the Iraq team is still playing today, right?
They will be in suburban Bridgeview. Iraq is playing in a training match against Venezuela tonight at 8 o'clock. I think that's why the coalition just wants to get ahead of that and make sure people know what to expect.
Sticking with sports, Mitch, you've been on the road with the White Sox. Would you just
How
get
fun?
You just got back from Philly?
From Philly, where they're getting ready for some FIFA matches there.
Yeah. How would you sum up the start to the season so far?
Sox are surprising all of baseball. They're a few games over 500, which doesn't sound that impressive, but they've been basically the worst or second worst team in baseball each of the last three seasons.
Right.
And right now they are half a game ahead of the Cubs, actually, which is kind of a stunner at this point of the season. So we'll see how long they can keep it up, but things are looking up in general.
You have a story outlining all the possible All-Stars on the
team. That's right. The Sox have only sent one player to the All-Star game each of the last 3 years. But there's a few options. We've talked a lot about Munetaka Murakami, Clear's mm-hmm. favorite player.
Yes, Mooney.
And,
wait, is he still injured?
He'll probably be healed up right around the All-Star game. Unclear if he'd be able to actually play, but he's certainly a contender. The player I think is even just fun to think about even being considered is Tristan Peters, former Savannah Banana, former SIU Saluki. He's a Canadian, and the Sox basically got him for a bucket of baseballs in the offseason, and he's really turned into one of their most solid players. So really just a kind of a fun, surprising story from Tristan Peters.
Who's your pick for the All-Star team?
I think Davis Martin is a lock. He's been really impressive as the ace of the White Sox staff, and he's another fun story, a guy who's gone through a lot. He blew out his elbow a few years back, basically missed the better part of two seasons. He was on the all-time worst Sox team in 2024 when they lost 121. So he's really been there for the whole gamut of White Sox emotions over the last few years.
The come-up story.
That's right.
Yeah, I love that. What other stories are you watching out for, Claire?
Yeah, this is kind of interesting news from last week, but remember when the Eisenhower Expressway was shut down for, 9 hours,
yeah.
which is kind of incredible? The bomb squad was called, federal officials were investigating, so we now know what caused the explosion. It was a firework. So NBC Chicago reporting that
really?
A firework mortar went off inside this SUV that was being driven, unfortunately, by the 47-year-old who is now deceased. But a senior law enforcement said that the fireworks rocket was ignited inside of the vehicle and then shot, unfortunately, into the driver's chest. So the Cook County Medical Examiner is still investigating the manner of death, but it was a firework in a car gone wrong.
Wow.
And that's why you sometimes have to investigate something for 9 hours.
Yeah.
To the dismay of people trying to ride the Abba Nike.
Absolutely.
But that's why.
Other stories you two are watching out for. You first, Courtney.
Ooh, I'm excited. The Grant Park Music Festival kicks off tomorrow.
Does
so
it?
Free music outside. Get out and enjoy. Maybe not this week. It might be a little muggy out there, but happening all summer long.
Yeah. The mugginess is going to continue, Courtney, I think. So just go out there. And we've got our new principal conductor, too, right? Giancarlo Guerrero. So
yeah. He's been there a couple seasons, but yeah, he's
second
great.
Second season. So. Awesome. That'll be great to check out. Mitch, what about you?
Oh, this is my least favorite news story about the Bears stadium. Today we'll hear from Governor J.B. Pritzker, his first public comments since the Bears announced their latest shift in focus over to Hammond, Indiana. So it'll be interesting just to see what his take is on sort of the next steps in this five-year saga.
Saga is the right word. That is Mitch Armantrout with the Sun-Times and WBEZ's Courtney Kippers and Claire Lane.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Linnea Dominic, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in-the-loop. Thanks for listening.